Good evening. Nice to see each of you. And welcome to Augustana and to the Ronning Center lecture this evening. I'm pleased to introduce to you Dr. Norton Mizvinsky, who is the Emeritus Distinguished Connecticut State University Professor and Emeritus Professor of History at Central Connecticut State University. He's taught courses on terrorism in the modern world, on the history of the modern Middle East and Arab-Israeli conflict, and the history of Judaism. He's published extensive works on the struggles in the Near East, on Zionism, and on the American involvement in Israel. Dr. Mizvinsky is the president of the International Council for Middle East Studies, which is a new academic think tank in Washington, D.C. And on the way down here, in our conversation, I was delighted to hear a fair bit about how here in this wonderful agricultural land of Alberta, we can welcome a boy from Ames, Iowa. The first person, can I say this? Sure I can. The first person to be publicly circumcised in an Iowa town. So, comes from a small, or a town where his family was the first Jewish family, and he grew up in that context. So we're pleased to have you come and speak with us about the issue of Israel and the Palestinian people and this extraordinary and difficult and seemingly hard to imagine how it will ever be resolved in the Near East. I know that for me, the demands of this issue are beyond my capacity, and it is a source of great sorrow for so many of us. So we appreciate you coming and look forward to your talk with us this evening.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here. I was in Edmonton last spring. I was also in Calgary. And this trip, I'm in both places. I've been in both places as well. And I've had a good time in both places. And thank you for your kind introduction. Now, I remember, although it was a bit longer ago than yesterday, when I was in graduate school studying to be an historian, my major professor, who himself was a great historian, told me and my student colleagues repeatedly, historians are not prophets. Since then, I've always kept that statement in mind, especially because I so admired and respected my major professor. Nevertheless, I shall begin my presentation today by suggesting that the near-term future prospects for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict are not good, and that it is most likely that the conflict will worsen even more in the foreseeable future. Since I like to be optimistic rather than pessimistic, I, of course, do not relish saying this, but the facts on the ground, the recent developments, and the unfortunate lack of creative and constructive leadership on all sides dictate this prediction. All the more reason, I contend, for those of us concerned with this conflict not to resign ourselves to the present and apparently gloom near-term future, but rather to try to do whatever we can to suggest ways and even be actively involved, at least to some extent, in trying to evoke change for the better. Lawrence Wright's excellent and probing article of reportage on the recent Israeli incursion into Gaza titled Letter from Gaza Captives in the November 9, 2009 issue of the New Yorker, which is available online, provides some of the context for my pessimistic prediction, and I start out suggesting that would be quite a good article to look at for those of you who are interested. The much-discussed, recently released, 574-page Goldstone report on what occurred in Gaza from late December 2008 through early January 2009, submitted to the United Nations Human Rights Commission, based upon 188 individual interviews, 10,000 pages of documents, 1,200 photos, including satellite imagery, and 30 videos, adds blistering specificity to what Wright analyzes in his article and to what others have described. The evidence of the inhumane, extremely oppressive, murderous attacks against one another by Palestinian suicide bombers and rocket launchers, Hamas militants shooting rockets in the nearby Israeli Jewish areas, and the Israeli governments and Israeli defense forces killing and wounding of Palestinians, mostly civilians in Gaza, are but one part of the problem. The horrible human conditions for the over 1.5 million Palestinians in Gaza, exacerbated by sanctions and blockades that are stopping today many deliveries of food, medicine, and other necessities to, and the severe travel restrictions for the inhabitants of Gaza, constitute another part of the problem. United Nations statistics estimate that the unemployment rate in Gaza is somewhere between 50 to 60%. In the spring of 2006, the estimates were that the majority of the Palestinian population in Gaza was below the subsistence level, and the percentage now is without much question even higher. Child malnutrition is extremely high, as is disease. Children are rummaging through rubbish for food. According to the United Nations and to the few psychologists and psychiatrists in that area, the depression of children is at a devastating level. Danger of sewage and water shortages are growing problems. Fishermen are often prevented from fishing, and anyway, the water in which those fish are is polluted. The Israeli government, unfortunately, seems intent upon maintaining and even increasing the oppression of Palestinians in Gaza so long as the Hamas political leaders are, as they are, in control. The Hamas political leadership, on the other hand, while maintaining their political control in Gaza since the last Palestinian election, are divided in certain ways politically and religiously, and although they have provided social services for their people, are often crude in their attempts to govern and have not developed an agreed-upon, well-thought-out, constructive strategy for attempting to deal with the Israeli government. Some of these Hamas leaders continue to advocate that all of Palestine, including the present state of Israel, should be an Islamic state. The Hamas charter, which has not been revoked, is not only absurd in part, but is damaging to the Palestinian cause. It cites as evidence about Jews, for example, the classic anti-Semitic forgery, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and it links Zionism incorrectly to the Freemasons, the Lions Club, and other, I'm quoting from the Charter, spying groups that aim to violate consciences, to defeat virtues, and to annihilate Islam, quote unquote. Other Hamas leaders are more pragmatic, and they say they are willing to discuss, with no preconditions, the possibilities of resolution of conflict with the Israeli government. Hamas political leaders are thus divided in outlook, and anyway, have not even been able to agree to a unified Palestinian leadership with the Fatah political leaders who control the West Bank, who are also, in terms of leadership, we could say negative. Yet another part of the overall problem is the Israeli occupied territory of the West Bank, including Jerusalem, annexed by the State of Israel, as you probably know, after the 1967 war. For the over 2 million Palestinians living in that area, the living conditions, although not so severely bad as for the Palestinians in Gaza, are bad, well below any reasonably acceptable humane standards for most of the population. The conditions in the refugee camps of that area are especially bad. The evidence for this is overwhelming. The United Nations and numerous international and even Israeli Jewish human rights organizations whose members work in that area have provided easily obtainable documentation. Travel for Palestinians in the West Bank is severely restricted. Palestinian land confiscation by the Israeli government continues consistently, and various other forms of oppression and intimidation of Palestinians remains a constant. According to the Israeli Defense Forces, their civil administration report covering the first half of 2009, according to that report, there were 304,569 Jewish residents living in the West Bank. That's in the first half of 2009. That's an increase of 2.3% since January of 2009. Most of the growth was in the most religious communities, including the ultra-Orthodox settlements. The settlers in these religious communities are the most extreme anti-Palestinian Jewish settlers. They believe that God gave the Jews an eternal deed to the entire West Bank as part of the Promised Land. They will cite biblical chapters that, for example, chapter 12, in Hebrew it's Lech Lecha, of the book of Genesis. Their position and advocacy on the basis of biblical text reportage of God's words can be challenged and refuted, but that is not presently my point. If we include East Jerusalem, captured in the June 1967 war and annexed by Israel, the number of Jews who, of course, can be called settlers, swells upward towards 400,000. Let me give you a few broader statistics. The number of Jewish settlers has more than doubled in the West Bank since the early 1990s and has grown at about 5% annually since Israel formally adopted, didn't follow, but it formally adopted the Bush Roadmap in May 2003. The Labor, the Likud, the Kadima governments have backed and supported settlement expansion with economic subsidies, essential infrastructure and military protection, as well as an array of roads, checkpoints, and security measures. Natural growth has become the wording of the central rationale that the present Netanyahu government has made for why settlements need to expand. The official figures, however, do not support this argument. According to the Israeli Central Bureau of Statistics, the annual population growth for the Jewish settlements in the West Bank is 5.9%, 3.5 times higher than for Israel itself. This suggests, at least, that immigration is the major cause of population expansion, not birth rate. For instance, in 2007, some 36% of all new settlers immigrated from Israel or abroad. One-third to two-fifths of the settlement population growth during the last decade has been the result of heavily subsidized migration, not family expansion, according to a variety of Israeli experts. Many of the religious settlers, moreover, have made it clear that they will block any attempt to dismantle any settlements. They have launched what they call Operation Price Tag, which organizes riots to smash Palestinian cars, assault Palestinian farmers, and burn fields and olive groves at times that they think, mostly incorrectly, that the government might slow settlement construction. In addition to all of this in the West Bank is the wall being built by the Israeli government for the past couple years that has clearly limited Palestinian suicide bombers to some extent, but has also resulted in more confiscation of Palestinian land by the Israeli government and by the Jewish settlers, and has increased oppression of the Palestinians in many ways. The wall itself has taken different forms, but it's striking. In some places, it has huge towers with electric sensors. In other places, it's a very large concrete structure. The first goal was to make it 680 kilometers in length. It'll probably be longer. One-third of it was built by 2005. More than two-thirds of it have been built by now. 80%, it's 80% inside Palestinian territories, and as it's built, more and more Palestinian land then is confiscated by the Israeli government and by the settlers, because on one side only Jews can be, and on the other side only Palestinians can be. In July 2004, the International Court of Justice at The Hague condemned the wall as illegal. Illegal because it was confiscating Palestinian land, preventing free movement of people and goods, and violating rights of Palestinians to seek work, health, and education. Well, I've got a lot more on the wall, but you get the point. In early October 2009, 21 human rights activists from South Africa visited Israel. That group included members of Nelson Mandela's National Congress, two South African Supreme Court judges, a former deputy minister, members of parliament, attorneys, writers, and journalists. Some were Jews, some were blacks, some were whites. They visited Nablus, the most imprisoned city in the West Bank, and other cities and towns as well. Many of them were quoted in the Israeli Hebrew press as saying that what they observed in terms of oppression of Palestinians by Israel and enforced apartheid, that's their term, by the Israeli government was worse than what the situation had been in South Africa before the change. There are a good many articles that were written on this. See, for example, the article by Gideon Levy titled Twilight Zone Worse Than Apartheid in the October 7th, 2009 issue of Haaretz, one of Israel's three leading Hebrew language newspapers. Madela Rutledge, the Deputy Defense Minister of South Africa from 1999 to 2004, who served time in prison in 1987, charged as a black activist, she said this, and this was quoted in Haaretz, quote, "The situation is worse than apartheid because of the absolute control of people's lives, the lack of freedom of movement, the army presence everywhere, the total separation, and the extensive destruction we saw." Mandi Makiana, the editor of the Sunday Times of South Africa, stated, quote, "Nothing can prepare you for the evil we have seen here in a certain sense. It is worse, worse, worse than anything we endured. The level of the apartheid, the racism, and the brutality are worse than the worst period of apartheid." Unfortunately, the Fatah political leadership, as I said before, in the West Bank, under the leadership of Mahmoud Abbas, although apparently reformist in some ways, and certainly less corrupt than Arafat's previous Fatah ruling leadership, has not been creative at all in attempting to deal with Israeli oppression. Granted, the task here has been and is difficult. But for too long, Abbas relied upon some good words, but obviously hypocritical intentions of Israeli political leaders, and I must say the Obama administration as well, in attempting to deal with the Israeli government. Abbas has, within the past few weeks, changed somewhat in this regard, but has not been able to make his peace with Hamas leaders in Gaza and thus unite the Palestinian leadership. Even more telling, Abbas has now stated that he will not try to remain the head of Fatah, he will not try to remain the Palestinian president in the West Bank after his present term is soon over. Another part of the present political situation is in Israel behind the green line. That is Israel's border up to June of 67. There we have another problem. In that area, in the state of Israel, there are 1.3 million Palestinians who are citizens of the state of Israel. The 3.5 million Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank, they, of course, are not allowed to be citizens. Here we have 1.3 million citizens. Admittedly, the living conditions for these Israeli Palestinians is overall significantly better than for Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. Yet, these Palestinians are second-class citizens at best in the state of Israel. As non-Jews, they do not have, by statutory law, many rights and privileges given to Jewish citizens of the state. Therefore, they, for example, cannot buy, rent, or lease by law well over 90% of the arable farmland in the state, which has been designated by the Israeli government Jewish National Fund land. And by law, Jewish National Fund land cannot be sold, rented, or leased to non-Jews, even to non-Jewish citizens. Palestinian citizens by law cannot live in certain areas. There are tens of laws. Again, laws that grant rights and privileges to Jews, not granted to non-Jews in Israel. Upward economic and social mobility, then, for most Palestinian citizens, is limited in most spheres as compared to Jews. If time permitted, well, we could consider more of these restrictions and limitations. Suffice it to say that Israel is a democratic state from any reasonable comparative perspective for Jews, but is not on balance democratic for non-Jews, even for non-Jewish citizens. It is important to analyze, it seems to me, the present Israeli-Palestinian situation, which I just briefly analyzed, within its larger contextual framework. Too often these days, the considerations are those that date back only to 1967 and the Israeli occupation of territory captured in the June War of that year. To understand the total situation, or to put it in context, we need to remember and understand what happened in 1948, when about 750,000 Palestinians were displaced, some killed and some wounded, shoved off their land and into other countries. That was, to use the Arabic Palestinian remembrance word, the Nakba, which has a significant practical and devastating happening, greatly exacerbated conflict, and set a broad framework of enormous antagonism that has now come down from parents to children to grandchildren. Again, had we more time, we could and should say more about this. Behind and beyond 1948 and the Nakba, the underlying theoretical foundation, indeed the heart center of the whole conflict, is Zionism, which was legislated into and became the character of the State of Israel. I regret that, time does not permit us to pay the attention to Zionism that it deserves. Be that as it may, Zionism is best defined as one, certainly not the only, type of Jewish nationalism. Or in other words, one of the ways in which some Jews have sought to define the past, present, and future of the Jewish people. As opposed to what some proponents of Zionism contend, Zionism dates back not to the time of Abraham or to some other ancient period, but rather only to the mid to late 19th century of the Common Era. Building upon what a few others had earlier suggested, Theodor Herzl, a Viennese journalist, concretized the theory of Zionism in the 1890s. Zionist theoreticians have debated and discussed certain aspects around the fringe of Zionism since then, but the central essence of Zionism has remained intact. It hasn't changed. And it consists of 2 points, and they're not very difficult to understand. The first is an absolute theory of anti-Semitism. Absolute. It goes like this. Jews have been in the past, and or are being in the present, and or will be in the future. That's past, present, and future. Jews will be persecuted by non-Jews in all nation states in which they are a minority. Therefore and thereby, now we come to point number two. Jews need to have a nation state of their own where they start out as the majority, hopefully of all the residents. That's not possible. Then of the citizens who control the state, and they must maintain that majority. If they don't maintain it, we go back to point number one. A movement developed from this theory, as you probably know, it gained some strength among Jews, some strength. Not a tremendous amount of strength, but some strength among Jews for some decades, and there were some increasing numbers of Jews who did go to Palestine. But it probably succeeded because of the unfortunate happening of the Holocaust, one of the most horrible happenings, as you know, of the 20th century, over 6 million Jews killed in Europe. Zionism was immediately legislated into the character of the State of Israel after Israel came into existence. As mentioned previously, this is evident in a number of ways. Jews were by law given rights and privileges not given to non-Jews, and the requirement that Jews remain a majority of the citizenry was underlined. Although large majorities of Orthodox and Reform religious Jews had rejected Zionism before the Holocaust for various reasons, most of them, not quite all, but most, rallied behind it and blindly supported the State of Israel after that state came into existence. The major motivation for the support of and for the policies of the State of Israel since 1948 have stemmed from the belief in the tenets of Zionism. In 1923, Vladimir Jabotinsky, a militant Russian Zionist leader, outlined his Iron Wall strategy for the Zionist movement, which was then intent, 1923, upon acquiring a Zionist Jewish state in historic Palestine. The Iron Wall strategy emphasized the use of force to convince Arabs to accept this Zionist Jewish state in their midst. Jabotinsky based his suggested strategy upon the idea that Arabs, especially the indigenous population of Palestine, those people who became known as Palestinians, would not be willing to accept Zionism and a Zionist state in Palestine is just, and that it was unreasonable to expect them to do so. Jabotinsky believed, and the Zionist movement accepted, that Zionism should demand only that Arabs accept the reality and permanence of a Zionist state in Palestine to which Jewish immigration would be allowed to continue unabated. To achieve this end, Jabotinsky advocated that the use of force would be necessary. And Zionists then utilized this force, and they did so often cruelly before and after Israel became a state. What happened in 1948 is but one example. From then until the early 1990s, Israeli governments followed and used this Iron Wall strategy and were almost without exception backed and supported by governments of the United States, especially other nation states as well. In the 1970s, Abe Iban, the then Israeli foreign minister, eloquently illustrated the rationale for this Iron Wall strategy when he stated in a United Nations speech, quote, "We do not ask any recognition of our right to exist because our right is independent of any recognition of it," end quote. Until the early 1990s, Israel then asked Arabs for acceptance of the fact of the state's existence, not for recognition of the legitimacy of the Zionist state. Now, Israeli leaders have more recently shifted. They have demanded that Arab leaders, including, of course, Palestinians, accept Israel as a Zionist Jewish state and accept the legitimacy of that. Doing so would stamp an approval upon Zionism itself. In his December 2002 speech at the Herzliya Conference, which focused upon the posture of Israel's national security, the Prime Minister Ariel Sharon asserted that Israel's desire to live in security in what he termed true and genuine coexistence necessitated the recognition of our national and historic right to exist legitimately as a Jewish Zionist state in the land of Israel. Even more recently, the previous Prime Minister, Ehud Olmert, and previous Foreign Minister, Tzipi Livni, asserted likewise. The current Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, and others in his administration have expanded this demand, and they now say it is a condition that must be accepted before Israel will engage in any further negotiations about any issues of conflict. To date, the Obama administration in Washington has endorsed this Israeli demand. Significant numbers of Arabs, not all, but significant numbers, have within the recent past accepted the reality of Israel's existence as a state, but have not accepted the Israeli demand that Arabs accept and thereby endorse the legitimacy of the state of Israel to exist as that kind of state. The United States government has endorsed and advocated this condition, as I've just said, and of course that follows the almost complete backing and support, political, military, economic, by U.S. governments of Israeli foreign policy since 1967 and mostly from 1948 to 19, mostly since 1967, but also from 48 to 67. A year ago, when Obama was elected, he aroused high hopes, as I'm sure you know, in the Muslim world, among the Palestinian people, as well as among the Israeli peace camp. At long last, an American president who understood that he had to put an end to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, not only for the sake of the two peoples, but mainly for the United States' national interest. That was the thought. This conflict is largely responsible for the tidal waves of anti-American hatred that swept Arab Muslim masses from ocean to ocean. So a great many people believed with Obama that now a new era had begun. Instead of the clash of civilizations, as some people put it, the axis of evil and all the other idiotic but faithful slogans of the Bush era, a new approach of understanding and reconciliation, mutual respect, and practical solutions. That's what people thought. Nobody expected Obama to exchange the unconditional pro-Israeli line for a one-sided pro-Palestinian attitude. But most people thought that the United States would henceforth adopt a more even-handed approach and push the two sides towards the two-state solution. And no less important, that the continuous stream of hypocritical and sanctimonious blabbering would be displaced by a determined, vigorous, non-provocative, but purposeful policy. As high as the hopes were then, so deep is the disappointment now. Nothing of all of these things has come about. Worse, the Obama administration has shown, by its actions and omissions, that it is not really different from the administration of George W. Bush. From the first moment, it was clear that the decisive test would come in the Battle of Settlements, the first decisive test. It may seem that this is a marginal matter. If peace is to be achieved within 2 years, as Obama's people assured us, why worry about another few houses in the settlements that will be dismantled anyway? So there'll be a few thousand settlers more to settle. Big deal. But the freezing of settlements So, but the freezing of settlements has an importance far beyond its practical effect. To return to the metaphor of the Palestinian lawyer, we are negotiating the vision of a pizza, and in the meantime, Israel is eating the pizza. The American insistence on freezing the settlements, that's what Obama talked about, in the entire West Bank and East Jerusalem was the flag of Obama's new policy. As in a Western movie, Obama drew a line in the sand and declared, up to here and no further, a real cowboy cannot withdraw from such a line without being seen as yellow. That is precisely what has now happened. Obama has erased the line he himself drew in the sand. He has given up the clear demand, even for a total freeze. Benjamin Netanyahu and his people announced proudly and loudly that a compromise had been reached, not, God forbid, with the Palestinians, who are they anyway, but with the Americans. They have followed Netanyahu to build here and build there for the sake of natural increase, completing unfinished projects and other transparent pretexts of this kind. There will not, of course, be any restrictions now in building in Jerusalem, the undivided eternal capital of Israel. In short, the settlement activity will continue in full swing. To add insult to injury, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton troubled herself within the past couple weeks to go to Jerusalem in person in order to shower Netanyahu with a good deal of flattery and then to tell all of the Arab world there is no precedent to the sacrifices he is making for peace. That's what she said, because now they took away freeze, and now he says, well, he'll, from his point of view, slow down expansion of the settlements. Well, I don't have to go on with any more than that. Now, if we ask the question, I barely have time to get into this, but I'll raise the question and give a brief answer. If we raise the question, why has Obama been as he has been? After all, we're talking about the President of the United States, and like it or not, I don't always like it so much. I'm an American citizen. That's my government. But still, if it's my government, then if I don't like some of the policies, I feel an obligation to stand up and say so. Otherwise, it could be assumed that I go along with them. But if the question is, why has Obama been as he has been? In May 2009, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, the heart center of the Israel lobby in the United States, drafted a letter warning Obama to work closely and privately with Israel. APAC got 329 signatures in the House of Representatives and 76 out of 100 in the Senate. During August 2009, 56 members of Congress visited Israel, and members of Congress, of the House and of the Senate, and House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer spoke to reporters on their behalf and said it was a mistake to make settlement construction any kind of big issue. If Obama did try to make aid to Israel, for example, any aid to Israel, not all of it, but part of it, if he tried to make aid to Israel conditional on a settlement freeze even, Congress would simply override him. He undoubtedly knows that. Any attempt to put real pressure on Israel risks alienating key politicians and major fundraisers in both parties, as well as Israel's media supporters. This could imperil the rest of Obama's agenda and conceivably his prospects for re-election. Moreover, many of Obama's top advisors, including Dennis Ross, are enthusiastic supporters of the United States' special relationship with Israel and would almost certainly oppose and have opposed using United States leverage to try to force Israeli concessions. The reasons appear fairly obvious. They are not different than reasons have been in the past, unfortunately. So there we have it in terms of the gloomy prospects for the near future. Within the context of the totality of this conflict. And so let me conclude by just saying something very briefly about solutions that have been proposed for this conflict. I'll say solutions that are somehow off in the future. There are two solutions that have been most aired, as you probably know. One of them exists and is factual and hasn't even been talked about very much, doesn't have to be talked about. It's the status quo. I mean, the Israeli government stays with the status quo. A good many people in other places stay with the status quo, and they simply advocate one side or another. But another solution, as you probably know, that's been talked about a great deal, certainly talked about in the United States as well as in Israel, and certainly as well as among Palestinians and in the Arab world, and actually been proposed rather ambiguously, is a two-state solution. That somehow Palestinians would have a state in Gaza and in certain parts of the West Bank. The Arab world says in the whole West Bank. Others say in certain parts of the West Bank, and so on. That's the other solution that has been most often put. Let me suggest to you that the status quo is not a positive approach. The two-state solution, as it's been proposed, is a fantasy. We have 300,000 to 400,000, depending whether you want to look at Jerusalem or not, Jewish settlers in the West Bank, and since 67, steadily, if we drew a line on the chart, be straight up. Steadily, those settlements have been expanded, and as I pointed out, there is nothing to indicate any slowing down, and there's nothing to indicate that any Israeli government, be it a Likud government of Netanyahu, a Kadima government, or be it a Labor government, would turn away from the settlements. After all, the settlement policy was devised by Labor right after the 67 more Labor governments, and the first settlements were built by Labor governments. Sometimes the words of Labor governments in Israel are different than the parties to the right, but the actions have been the same. Well, that's the settlements. 400,000 of those settlements, by the way, divide, as you probably know, that South African group just saw this. They divide the Palestinian population in many places in the kind of, we could say, former South African kinds of Bantustans. Well, what kind of state could we have from that? And a good deal of the money for the expansion has come from the United States. That's just one of the problems. Then there are other problems. 750,000 Palestinians displaced in 1948. They, their children, and their grandchildren, most of them. It's understandable. Think of the advocacy what you wish. It's understandable. They're saying, listen, there's a law of return in Israel that any Jew from anywhere in the world can go to Israel and opt to become a citizen and become a citizen immediately. We can't even go back to visit, let alone become citizens. So in any kind of solution, we should have the right of return as well. If you go to Israel, as I'm sure some of you have done, you'd be hard-pressed, very hard-pressed, to find, you could find some. I could tell you a few. You could find some. But even you'd be hard-pressed to find people in the Israeli peace camp, for example, who would agree to any return of Palestinians. If you have one or two come in, you open the door a crack, and you know that kind of argument. You open it a crack, and then you're going to open it wider. And we can understand why we get that argument. We get that argument because of demography. After all, Palestinians now, the estimates are that Palestinians not only have one of the highest birth rates in the world, they have the highest birth rate in the world. Israeli Jews have one of the lowest birth rates. Last September, there were as many, this is according to the Israeli government, there were as many Palestinian kindergarten school children, if we include the occupied territories, as there were Jewish kindergarten school children. And well, so it won't be long until The Palestinian population is greater. Well, you get the idea. If you go to Israel, as I often do, and you walk down the street and you ask people, what do you consider to be the biggest Jewish problem? Jews like to talk sometimes about the Jewish problem. Greeks like to talk about the Greek problem. Italians like to talk about the Italian problem. The Jews aren't any different here. But if you ask them, my guess is most of them won't say number one suicide bombers. They'll say number one demography in one way or another. That's easy to understand. I'm saying that's a huge problem. We can understand the intensity of the feeling of return on the Palestinian side, the right of return. Well, we can also understand the intensity of the concern on the Israeli-Jewish side against any return. I could go on and on. We have many of those problems. Those problems alone make a two-state solution, it seems to me, a fantasy, at least a fantasy for the present. What kind of two-state solution could we possibly have? So I'm going to suggest that if we're looking ahead, we have to look ahead and we have to be realistic. And what's realistic? What's realistic is this is one state. It is one state. I mean, there it is, Israel behind the green line and the occupied territories. And so since it's one state anyway, then it seems to me we, the collective, mainly the two parties, Palestinians and Israeli Jews, would have to move step by step. But so my suggestion is, let me put it rhetorically, why not be concerned and argue for human rights? The Israeli government tells us repeatedly that Israel is a democratic state. Already said it's democratic for Jews, but not for non-Jews. Okay. Let's take that argument and say we have one state and the Israeli government says it is, therefore it must want a democratic state. So let's advocate having that one state become a better state and become a more democratic state, and we would probably have to move slowly, step by step, if that is possible. Well, with that kind of suggestion, I'll end and I'll open it up to you. Thank you very much.
Well, very optimistic. Please.
Sir, thank you very much. That was very informative. My question is the birth rate differential, the birth rate of the Palestinians, why wouldn't that just take care of the problem and that can sort of let the universe unfold just the way it should?
Well,
without regard to Bush and Obama, whoever, just the birth rate will solve it,
won't it? Well, because population is one thing, but we also know, not only in this world today, but this has been the case before, power is something else. The state of Israel, according to the most authoritative source is a British publication called Jane's Fighting Ships. And it says the state of Israel is the fourth strongest military power in terms of traditional weapons in the whole world. That's striking, but true. Now, in nuclear power, from what we know, there may not be three countries ahead of Israel in nuclear power. The whole Arab world, not just Palestinians, is no match for Israel militarily, and Israel has the United States government behind it. You know, like it or not, still, the United States is a big superpower. The United States made Israel that great military power. Now, Israel has existed for, 62 years. 62 years. And now Israel's stronger than ever. Palestinians are weaker than ever. So, yes, we may have a big population increase, but
one Israeli government after another, with the United States behind it, has demonstrated that it can certainly control Palestinians and do what it wants most of the time. Yes, there were troubles here and there of suicide bombers. I'm not diminishing that. I mean, there were those things should be condemned. They were terrorist acts. But Israel controlled that pretty much. Hamas militants have shot rockets. Israel still has to be concerned with that. But Israel has been able to handle that. So, yes, in terms of population and population growth, and that will increase for Palestinians, that will say, it will increase for Palestinians, but there's also this power thing. And so I would come back and I would ask the question, well, how long do we want to see and to have and to try to do nothing about or say nothing about the continued horrible oppression of those people who live there? Now, it's gone on for 62 years. It's gone on even more for the last 42 years since 1967. Well, I would say to you, it could probably go on for decades and decades and decades if we just say, let's just let the population go as it goes.
And you're saying that the suicide bombers and the mortar attacks, that's something Israel can handle.
Look. If one person is killed, then there's a human argument that you're not handling it. If one person's killed. But, you know, there are some other ways to look at it. Sure, Israel has cut back the number of suicide bombs. Does that mean that Israeli Jews will be able to live with no danger at all? No, there is danger, but they've been able to control that fairly well. Palestinians are no match for Israel. The whole Arab world is no match for Israel. Look, that reminds me of one other thing. There's been this about safety and not safety, and this is something that I always say turns Zionist theory on its head anyway, it seems to me. You know, the argument, and I told you, the essential argument of Zionism is that the only place Jews are going to be safe is in the Zionist state, where Jews are in a majority and remain a majority. We've had that Zionist state for 62 years. And every year, when the state of Israel goes out to collect money, whether it's the U.S. government or individuals, to collect money and to collect political support for the state of Israel, what's the argument we get? And by the way, it's not a coincidence that in the states, we always get the major all-in-one drive during Holocaust week. But what's the argument? The argument is give money and give support to the state of Israel because the Jews of Israel are living in the most unsafe place for Jews in the whole world. Well, it's been the Zionist state for 62 years, and it's simply not rational, it seems to me, to say that on the one hand, that is the only safe place for Jews to live, and on the other hand, it's the most unsafe place in the world for Jews to live.
Did you want to pursue that a bit more?
I want to thank the speaker for addressing the questions.
Okay. For what?
Thank you for addressing me.
Well, I tried. I don't know that I did it sufficiently.
Just a minute. Yes, up there.
Long before Israel was as powerful then as she is today, and we're going to go back to 1948, she accepted the conditions to be able to be established as a state alongside the Palestinians there, without the city of Jerusalem. She was forced in a position to defend herself to even be exist as a state for longer than a month. So could we not have had if two-state solution was of that much interest to the Palestinians, could they have just agreed on it at that time? Would we be having a discussion on it tonight?
Okay. Well, there's a lot to say about that. It's a good thing that you raised the point. There's a lot to say about it. And by the way, we have a lot of really good scholarship based upon source material and much of it comes from the Israeli side as well. As to what happened in 48. First of all, politically, Palestinians had no voice whatsoever in the United Nations. So, I mean, you know, we have a phrase in the United States people like to use about the U.S. About the revolution. The revolution was no taxation without representation. Well, Palestinians didn't have representation, but that's the smallest. There's a lot of evidence now from a lot of Israeli sources that, by the way, have been written about the best by some Israeli Jewish historians, especially the Israeli so-called new Jewish historians, that show that, well, there were lots of things that were said, but not to be necessarily carried through. We have a lot of evidence now from minutes of Zionist meetings and minutes of the Jews who were there, call them what you will, the people who made up the Jewish army, the Jewish militants, and so on, led by David Ben-Gurion, that, well, they really did not desire to have a Palestinian state. I'm not necessarily making that argument yet because the case is not so very clear. But I'm saying that politically, there's still a lot of question. Then we also have the point that's often made that's a sort of a companion to what you made, and that is, look, here was a decision by the United Nations and all the Arab governments started the war and so on and so forth, and the Arab governments told the Palestinians weren't forced off their land. The argument is that a Palestinian just left their land. Simply left their land. Is now, I would say, a myth that has been destroyed. First, we had a lot of evidence that came from some Arab historians. But let's put the Arab historians aside and say, you know, whether they were looking at documents or not, they were biased. We now have a whole variety, we have a whole number of studies written by Jewish historians with evidence taken from the records of the Israeli state archives that are records that from the Israeli government and what the Israeli government planned to do and then what the Israeli government did in terms of pushing Palestinians off their land. And we have some really, really good historians who have written, Israeli Jewish historians, Avi Shoaim, Benny Morris in his early works. I would say that the one best book on it is by an Israeli Jewish historian, Ilan Papi. It's called The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, that deals with the period from March to September 1948. That's before the state came into existence in May and after, March to September, when the Jewish leadership, and then it became the leadership of the state, had a plan. They devised a plan. They called it Plan Dalit. Why? They devised four plans. Dalit was the fourth one. As I'm sure some of you in the audience know, in Hebrew, numbers are the alphabet. Dalit is the fourth number. It's Plan Dalit. And Plan Dalit was a plan on doing what I said Jabotinsky advocated in 1923, using force to push Palestinians out, and even probably to kill and wound some, in order to scare other Palestinians so they would leave their land. The plan was devised and it was carried out, and this documentation comes from the Israeli state archives. So I'm saying, for 1948, for what happened politically and for what happened militarily, we've had some standard stories. Those standard stories don't hold. And what the full and total story is, we may not be able to say we have that yet because we haven't looked at all the records. But from the records we have, well, we have more than indications, as I've just put.
Here. Please.
Former President Jimmy Carter drew a lot of criticism when he used the term apartheid.
Yeah.
From what you said tonight, it might have been a mild term.
Yeah.
What I'm wondering is, and again, you don't like to be a prophet as a historian, but I wonder if you would project what your thoughts might be if there was a fully democratic Israel in comparison, let's say, to what's happened post-apartheid in South Africa in terms of the rights of people.
That's a very good question, and it raises, lots of considerations about, well, what kind of democratic state could you have that would give some potential
and then real, if it was necessary, protection to Jews who would become a minority in the state. And of course, we have, before I get to South Africa for a minute, we have a lot of possible models for that. We have a lot of possible models. We could have a federation, a confederation. We've had the United States, for one, some other countries too, but especially the United States, put a lot of money and a lot of military equipment and so on into Israel. Well, there could be lots of protections, not just for the Jews, even from the outside for a while, if necessary, but for the Palestinians as well. There are lots of ways that a more democratic state could be fully defined and constructed once we had gotten to the point where that really becomes a possibility. It seems to me if the process is going to be, let's be human rights advocates, not just for Jews and not just for Palestinians, but human rights advocates for human beings, and let's go then step by step in saying that this should become a more democratic state, it's going to take us a while to get to where we then would have to have some kind of plan as to what kind of structure that state would have. But you know, if there's move in that direction, well, then there might be ways, there probably are ways, to cut down the oppression of people and the killing of people and the wounding of people, and that itself would be an offense.
It's such an interesting issue, because I think it's beyond Israel-Palestine as well. I think of, as you were talking about it, I couldn't help but think of Kosovo, where you also had this demographic issue that over a period of 40, 50 years completely shifted the politics on the ground. I expect we're going to be facing that in a number of places, and maybe even in Canada,
maybe,
with native people. So,
I was going to ask him. I spent quite a long time in the Middle East as a professor and teacher, and the hatred that is there is just unbelievable. Now, you haven't said anything about, you know, Iraq, Saudi, Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Pakistan, all of these other places that don't hate or that don't like the Jewish state. Now, what about involving some of these people to find out what do we really want to do here? Because right now, you talk to those people in the Middle East, and not one of them will tell you that they love the Jews.
Well,
and that guy in Iran right now, the way he talks, is a lot of the Egyptians and all these other Arabs think that way, but he's bold enough to talk. And so I think we have to include the total Middle East rather than just Israel and the Palestinians.
All right, thank you for that point. There's a lot to say, obviously, about that, too. First of all, I think I understand what you're getting at, but I would just caution you not to overgeneralize about all of the Arabs in the Middle East, even all the people in the governments. I mean, you know, you've been there, which I appreciate. I've been there, and I'm there every year, there being the Arab world and usually Israel as well. You and I are individuals, but we have our own experience of what we see in here. But then there are a lot of other people who have been there as well. And I think I can tell you that there are, if we're talking about just people, there are lots of people who are very upset. They hate what's been done. They don't have a hatred of Jews per se. And by the way, they also, many of them in one way or another, think that there should be a state where Jews are going to live and where Palestinians are going to live and so on. Yes, we have some numbers who don't feel that way. And I already mentioned with Palestinians, we have two major parties of a conflict. The Jews, Israeli Jews, and Palestinians. With the major parties, if we take Palestinians, and I look at that Hamas charter, and by the way, I talk with Hamas people, well, fairly often,
And some of them cite the kind of stuff that's in that charter. I mean, they have the kind of hatred you're talking about. But I can tell you that there are plenty of others who don't. They tell me, they said, we don't believe that stuff at all. Of course, I then say, you don't believe it? Then you're stupid. You should get it out of that charter if you don't believe it. So I'm saying, I don't think we can overgeneralize. But then let me point out something else that's pretty good evidence. It's now been a couple years that we have this proposal that was first put by the King of Saudi Arabia, as you know, and then it became the proposal of the whole League of Arab States. And it's a proposal, I don't think it's a realistic one, but it's one to cite here in answer to what you raised. It's a proposal for a two-state solution. And that proposal that the Saudi government put, and that now every government in the Arab world, that doesn't include Iran, I acknowledge that. Hold Iran for a minute. But every government in the Arab world has signed on to that, and that says, and by the way, the Fatah Palestinian leadership signed on to it. I don't think that counts for much. But anyway, what does it say? It says that if the state of Israel returns to the June 1967 borders, that is, no Jewish settlers, not one of those 400,000, none of that, gives up Jerusalem being annexed and so on, then we'll recognize the existence of the state and we'll accept the state. Now, I think it's a totally unrealistic thing. That's not going to happen in the near future. Israel's not going to dismantle those settlements. We don't have any evidence of that. But the point is, do I believe that they mean that? Yeah, I believe fully and totally, maybe not all of them, but many of them believe it. I mean, I believe, for example, the Saudi leadership, which I don't like very much at all. I mean, I've been to Saudi Arabia, too, twice, and I'll tell you that in many ways it's the most hypocritical society I've ever seen, and hypocritical in pretty bad ways. I think that most of them, not all, but most of the Saudi leaders, this is biased opinion, but I think it's based upon what I've seen and what I've read and what I know, they're interested more in making money and lighting their own pockets and so on. And as far as many of them are concerned, you know, if we didn't have this fighting and trouble going on, maybe we could have business deals with the state of Israel, and we would like to have, you know what I'm getting at. So I'm saying that, no, I don't think that necessarily holds. That is a problem with some numbers, for understandable but not good reasons, for some number of Palestinians, because they're the ones who have been most oppressed. Let me sum this up. I'm talking about it in a too lengthy manner, but let me sum this up by saying I think it's fairly clear. I think it's fairly clear, from just lots of evidence, that if there could be an agreement, which again you've heard me say, we're far, far away from that. If there could be an agreement on settlement between Israeli Jews, between the Israeli government and a Palestinian leadership that really represented all the Palestinians, then I think all the Arab world would fall behind that fully and totally. We have two examples of where two Arab governments made peace treaties with the State of Israel, but the situation has gotten worse since they did it in terms of the conflict. Egypt did it, of course, at Camp David. Well, the positive thing is, Egypt and Israel, that peace treaty has been rocky at times, but it's held. They haven't fought one another. But on the other hand, the conflict that's really the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has gotten worse. Jordan, in the later 90s, Jordan signed a peace treaty with Israel. The conflict since then has gotten worse. So I'm saying the fact that we have one or two or three Arab nation-state governments sign a treaty with Israel, that may be something, but that doesn't do much for the conflict. But I'm saying that if these two major parties sign the contract, the rest would come into line, and Iran, that's in a sense another story altogether. And you're quite right about the president of Iran in terms of what he has said. But you know, we now have lots of questions about where the power really lies in Iran. What will Iran do or not? Let me remind you that, of course, this is not Israel, but still it's something, that Iran has not attacked any country for a very, very long time. There was an Iraq-Iran war all through the 1980s, but that started with Iraq attacking Iran. And Iran hasn't attacked any country. Do I think that Ahmadinejad has enough power that if he could, he would just start a war against Israel? I seriously doubt it. And I'm not basing that upon what I think he thinks or what I think he feels. I don't really know what he thinks, and I don't really know what he feels. But I think that although he's demonstrated that in terms of what he says, he's not very smart, he's pretty stupid, I don't think he's totally stupid. I mean, I don't think he would do that. But that's just a guess. But if we talk about the Arab world, we have more to base things on.
I have one. Oh, if I can ask you, because I think people would be, a number of people here would be interested. Professor Novinsky is just completing a book on American evangelical Zionism. Since we're in this for the long haul,
yeah.
I mean, since this is a very large matter and is likely to be with us for a long time, can you say a little bit about the kind of, based on your work with this wing of Christians in America, could you say a little bit about what you're up to there, but also maybe with an eye towards how other Christians ought to maybe engage this matter a bit?
All right. Well, first of all, I told you in the car that I would say something about it in my remarks, and I didn't, so I apologize for you for not. I guess I got carried away with it.
My memory isn't going into
it. All right. All right. let me say, first of all, I'm about done with this book. Thank goodness, because it's dealing. I wrote a book with a leading Israeli scholar titled Jewish Fundamentalism in Israel, where I dealt with the ultra-religious Jews in Israel. And when I finished that book, I told myself, boy, I'm glad the book is finished. I'm really glad I did it, but I'm glad it's finished, because I don't know how I could keep my senses much longer if I had to keep dealing with that theology. But then I decided to do a book on Christian Zionism. And if I thought those Jewish, I'll call them fundamentalists, if I thought those Jewish fundamentalists were enough to drive me off the wall, the evangelical Christian...
Ours are better.
Yeah. Better or worse. I mean, yeah, all right. Now, all right. But having, yeah, all right.
It's always good to hear that Christians are better than Jews.
Yeah.
This is a long story.
Good. Okay. Yeah. All right. Now, look, first let me say that in terms of everything that I talked about today, especially the United States, this is a very big problem. We have something, I'm sure you know, we have something in the United States called the Israel Lobby. The Israel Lobby, there is no question about how much the Israel Lobby has affected American foreign policy. There's no question that it has affected American foreign policy to a great extent since and even before 48, more since 67. Whether it's done it this much or this much, maybe we don't know the degree, but it's been a major factor. Now, we have a Christian Zionist lobby. That's a different lobby
based upon a really not quite the same set of beliefs, and I'm going to pinpoint that in a minute. I would say that in the last 15 years at least, maybe a little longer, but certainly the last 15 years, the Christian Zionist lobby in the United States has been at least as powerful and as instrumental in helping shaping American policy in regard to Israel and the conflict than the Israel lobby. In fact, I'm probably making an argument now in my book at the end. I haven't written the end yet, but I'm probably going to make an argument that right now, today being the last decade, the Christian Zionist lobby is the most powerful lobby in the United States, period. The Israel lobby may have been one of the ones or one of the, but it's the most powerful, period. Why? Let me give you one basic fact. This is only one of the facts. Some of these Christian Zionist leaders say that they represent 100 million Americans. I can tell you that's an exaggeration. But I'm going to be able to document this. They represent 40 to 50 million Americans. They represent 40 to 50 million Americans. That's a lot. We only have 6 million Jews in the United States. The Israeli lobby is made up of Jews. The Israel lobby doesn't represent all 6 million Jews in the United States. Now, the Christian Zionist lobby, you know, some people tell me, listen, all those 40 or 50 million, they don't go along with every single thing that all the Christian Zionist leaders say. Well, the comeback to that is, they may not go along with every single thing, but to my knowledge, having looked at this and researched it for now the last 5 years, whenever those Christian Zionist leaders want emails sent to the White House, whenever they want people to go in and talk with members of Congress, whenever they want members of Congress threatened in one way or another, and they tell their people to do it, tremendous numbers though of those 40 or 50 million do it. So in numbers alone, they're big. Now, this is something briefly, and you know this very well, so I'm going to apologize for being too brief with the theology. But this theology is far different. It's not the Zionist thing that I gave you. It's not. We have a Jewish religious Zionist kind of theology too that I didn't have time to get into. But this Christian Zionist theology is different. Here it is in brief. Jews will have and must have. So you don't quite know sometimes where the emphasis is. They control, at least control, of the Holy Land. And that includes at least the present state of Israel. Maybe bigger borders, depending which Christian Zionist leaders you're listening to or you're reading. Jews must have control and will have control of the Holy Land, if not be the sole inhabitants. Some of them say the sole inhabitants. Before the second coming. Before the second coming of Jesus Christ. That's a belief. That's a belief. That's a belief. And so for them, it's a necessity. It's an obligation. It's a directive from God, which I'll illustrate to you in a minute. It's a directive from God for them to work for that in order to have the second coming prepared. Yes, they also say before the second coming, we'll have an Antichrist come. And most people who call themselves Christians, not the true believers, will follow the Antichrist. And by the way, almost all the Jews will follow the Antichrist because they say that there will only be 144,000 Jews who are saved from being destroyed during Armageddon. There are 5.7 million Jews in the state of Israel, according to the last census. There are maybe 15 million, we don't know for sure, 15 or 16 million Jews in the world. They say only 144,000 will be saved. But in the true believers will be raptured up in the air. I'm going to say in my book that they're going to have a grandstand seat, right, to Armageddon that goes on. But anyway, there it goes 7 miles up in the air. But anyway, now, so they say, Jews, now then they say, we therefore are obligated by directive. We have to help these Jews. We have to help these Jews. And we have to be sure that they have control. Some of them say, if they are pushing out the non-Jews, we have to help them do that. With money, with political work, and so on and so forth. I said I'd illustrate it. But there are some other things in theology, but that's it. You get the essence of it. When I was in Israel 3 years ago, and I was doing this research, I was in the first year or two, I first went to some members of the Israeli government then. Likud guy. I went to some members of the Israeli government whom I knew, and I have a lot of relatives in Israel, and they happen to be, I'm not proud of this, but of course they're not proud of my views either. They happen to be a very strong, very chauvinistic Israeli right-wing members of Likud. I mean, I have some relatives who are beyond Benjamin Netanyahu in terms of views. As far as I, what do they think of me? They think I'm a nice Jewish boy with a nice Jewish heart because I come from a good Jewish family. I just have wrong ideas. Well, okay. Now, but anyway, look, I went to some of them, and then they went to the others in the government, and I said I knew the answer, but I wanted them to tell me. I said, you know, you must know, here are these Christian Zionists, and you know, you're taking all this help from them, and you're arm in arm with them, but I said, you know, what about their theology? That in the end, there's going to be Armageddon, and all the 144,000 Jews are going to be killed. Well, what did they tell me? Just what you'd expect. They said, listen, of course their theology is nonsense, and we know it. But they said, they're helping us, of course. In this kind of conflict, we have to be Machiavellian. We have to take the help, any help we can get, especially that kind of help. And that's why the last four Israeli prime ministers have gone every year to one of the three international conferences, usually held in Jerusalem of Christian Zionists, and they said what I heard Ariel Sharon say twice. When I was there, when they had that conference, they've said to these Christian Zionists, you're our best friends in the world. And by the way, they rather meant it, because they knew that this Christian Zionist lobby in the United States was even more important than the Israel lobby for them. And they needed the United States. When I saw some of those ultra-Orthodox rabbis that Israel Shahak and I wrote about in our book and condemned, and when I saw that at people who have terrible views of non-Jews, the soul of a non-Jew compared to the soul of a Jew is compared to the soul of a human being and the souls of cattle, that kind of view. When I saw them arm in arm up on the stage with the Christian Zionists, well, anyway, so I said to them, well, what did these Israeli leaders say to me? They said that, you know, it's not, okay, then what did I do? I had made these appointments before I left. I went to three groups of evangelical Christian Zionists who were in Israel. There are always some of them there. Some go for a couple weeks. Some go, as you know, for a few months. I found one group, they were there for 9 months. Maybe some go for longer. I went to three groups, and I asked the leaders of those groups this question, same kind of question the other way. I said, listen, do you know, you must know, what Israeli government leaders and other Israeli Jews who know about you think about your theology?
And you're dancing.
What? Yes. Well, let me tell you what one of them told me. The others told me this too, but he told me this. He told me this more clearly. You know, the Israelis I went to, they all said their theology is nonsense. When I asked this Christian leader, he looked at me, and I didn't say anything about what I heard. I didn't use the word. He said, yes, he said, we know that they think our theology is nonsense, but we're not helping them. them because we're taking orders from them. We're helping them because we're taking orders from... And he did that. That's my illustration. That's what they believe. I don't have any question in my mind. Now, having read all this stuff and all this theology that is we talked about in the car, certainly goes back to the mid-19th century in some ways, I don't have any doubt that most of them, I think a couple of them are probably hypocrites, leaders who are just concerned with their own human profit in one way or another, but I don't have any doubt that most of these people believe it. Those people believe they have the Word of God to do what they're doing. That's really dangerous. It doesn't matter whether we're talking about Christians or Muslims or Jews or others. And we have people in probably any group who are like this. The ones who are doing horrible things and really believe they're doing it because God told them to do it, that's really dangerous. Because if a person believes that, how are other human beings going to be able to convince that person otherwise? I don't know the answer to that.
I think it's also called idolatry.
Okay.
It's shared tradition across all three. Please.
I was just wondering what it's like, we're sort of getting into American politics a little bit more, and I'm just wondering what it's like to be a politician, a congressman, a scholar, just broadly, wherever you want to go with it, in the United States. Because in Canada, it's different. Very different. It's different with like APAC. And, I mean, I had a little look on campus watch before I came just to see your presence there. And
oh, yeah.
They're certainly there.
They just love you,
yeah,
right?
They do. And so, I guess I'll just give it to you, and whatever you want to say about
well,
if
you're
off their job.
Well, you want me to give, I'll give you, since you looked at Campus Watch for me, I'll give you I'll talk about me personally. By the way, when I talk about what it is with me personally, there are others like me, and it's more or less the same. Now, with politicians, it's a little different. They can scare them more in some ways. But look, I've said the things that I'm saying to you, not just the gloomy for the president and so on, but in terms of Zionism and so on, I've done that for a long time. I mean, because it's caused commitment for me. Let's say I've done it for sure since the 67 war. That's 42 years. So, on the one hand, I've been called lots of things by some of them. You know the terms. An anti-Semitic, self-hating Jew. An anti-Semitic... I suppose there are worse things to be called, but that's pretty bad. And I'm called that, and there's all of it. Now, what has that meant for me? Now, I can only talk about me, because for other people, you know, it all depends on the human being. That's never stopped me. And not only has it never stopped me, I suppose it invigorates me all the more. I've always felt, for example, and I try to do this, I've always felt that I, as a Jew, have an obligation and commitment to say these kinds of things to Jews. I don't think obviously, I think I say them to non-Jews too, but I think I'm really obligated to say them to Jews. So I try my best to be able to talk to Jewish audiences. And I mean to talk to Jewish, not just to talk to Jewish audiences of people who are already critical. They may not be out here as far as I am in terms of being opposed to Zionism per se, but are critical of Israeli policies. I don't only mean talking with them. I mean talking with Jews who are as my relatives are. Now, that's not always easy to do, because if we're talking about certain groups, be they religious groups in some, and I underline some, certainly not all, in some synagogues, or be they Jews in other kinds of groups that are not religious, oftentimes they don't like people coming in and presenting these views, because maybe those people will put a question or two in the heads of some of the people. But as bad as you read about me in Campus Watch, I come from a good Jewish family. Well, that counts. I don't like it so much. Sometimes I think to myself, well, I'm not going to use the word racist, but I'll say there might be something tribal about that, and there probably is, but that doesn't bother me too much. I come from a good Jewish family, and if I try hard enough, and I get some of my relatives who don't like my views, but certainly are not calling me or people like me these names, they sometimes will help me. So I go in. Well, you can imagine, sometimes when I make those talks, I have a hard time getting through the first third of my speech. Mm-hmm. I mean, because, you know, you're a very good audience. But, I mean, you know,
names are light.
Yeah, well, yo, I've had lots of... So, I mean, there are those things. So, yeah, what about more serious threats? I mean, I have people ask me, have you ever gotten death threats? And the answer is, yeah, I've gotten death threats. Do I take them seriously? Well, not so seriously that it stops me, no. But a death threat is a death threat. I mean, it's something you stop and think about for a moment or two. So that happens. But let me say one other thing. There are two things that have happened in the States, and you may know about it. From now, I'm talking about people like me. I'm not talking about politicians. With the politicians, it's similar, but then there are some other considerations. They stand for election and so on, and that raises some other problems. But let me talk about people like me. Let's say academics. There are some academics, and some of you may know about this, there are some academics who have actually lost their jobs in the United States for expressing views like I've expressed. Whether they're Jews or non-Jews, both, but Jews too. They've lost their jobs. Some people have applied for jobs and not gotten jobs. But then there are others that that hasn't happened to. And well, you're looking at one that it hasn't happened to. And by the way, I'm not the only one. And this is a good thing. I've said some negative critical things about the U.S. government and about the United States here. This is a very positive thing in a sense. For 42 years before I retired from the university in June to do this thing in Washington, I was at the same university in the state of Connecticut. And Connecticut happens to be one of the states in the United States where academic freedom on the state level is, academic freedom is right at the top of the priority list. Academic freedom. That's important in the state. Now, at my university, listen, people would call the president of the university, they'd go in to see the president, and let me tell you, that never hurt me in the least. It didn't hurt me in terms of advancement. It didn't hurt me in any way at my university. And let me give you one example, a major example that happened when I first got there. I went there in January of 1968. That's when I started. January of 68. A year and a half after I started, there was a lawsuit started in the Federal District Court in Washington, D.C. And there were seven plaintiffs, of which I was one. All the plaintiffs were citizens of the United States. We had to be citizens in order to get standing in court, as I'm sure many of you understand. And it was a case in equity, I guess you would call it. And we named the defendants the Secretary of the Treasury of the United States of America and the Director of the Internal Revenue Service of the United States. Why? Because they had allowed people who gave to the all-in-one drive, the major drive for among Jews in the United States, quote-unquote philanthropic drive during the year, they had allowed those contributions to be tax-exempt. And we started the case and we pointed out, we had evidence that over 50% of the money collected in the all-in-one drive went to Israel, and a good deal of that in those years went to Israel, and the Israeli government bought arms with that money. And so our contention was that, by the way, that might not be legal in and of itself, apart from taxes. But we didn't argue that. Our argument was that this money certainly shouldn't be tax exempt. The case, by the way, the judge threw it out because he said it was political. It wasn't legal. Now, I thought it was wrong, but that's what I think. But that's not my point. My point is, we started this case, and I'm the one who got most of the evidence. And let me tell you how I got it. It's no secret. I grew up in Ames, Iowa. You're right. One of my best friends I grew up with, he was from Des Moines. He was Jewish. Des Moines is 27 miles away. We were good friends. He went on and became a CPA, Certified Public Accountant. And about the time that I went to New York, he went to New York too, and he got a job. And where did he get a job? He got a job in the Jewish Agency. That's an arm of the Israeli government. And he knew my views, and he and I had totally opposite views in those days in regard to Zion. Totally opposite. We used to have dinner together almost every Sunday night. One Sunday night he came and said, "Listen," he said, "I have to tell you this. I've been worrying about it for a long time." See, he saw money coming in, and he saw what was happening, and he said, "This money shouldn't really be tax exempt." Then he had a couple other things he told me about what went on, and he handled it. So he said, "You know," he said, "I can't stand that anymore, so I'm telling you," because he knew we'd started this lawsuit. And he said, "We can't take the documentation out of the Jewish Agency building. That would be unlawful." But he said, "I'll tell you," I said, "I figured out what we can do." He said, "I have the right to go in there in the evening to work." And he said, "I even have the right myself, since I work there, to take stuff home and work on it and bring it back." Now he said, "I'm not going to take it out, per se, just myself, but," he said, "I'll tell you what, if you come in with me, we'll look at the material together, you show me what you'd like, we'll make copies of it. We're not take the originals out. I'll take the copies out. I'll take them out. I have the right. Then I'll give them to you." Then he said, "If you use them in court," he said, "there is, with, I think some of you are lawyers, I think, so you know what the best evidence rule is. If the original exists, you have to use the original." But he said, "You know, if they come in and make that argument in court, if we get that far, we can say, okay, and we can then ask the court to subpoena the originals that are in the Jewish Agency building." So anyway, I got a lot of that stuff, and I put it in, and one day, now I come to me, one day the president of the university, I'd only been there a year and a half, he called me. And he asked me to come into his office in the middle of the day. And I went to his office. There were two men there. And he said, "Listen, Norton, I called you in here because I want these two men to say in front of you what they said about you when you weren't here." So they said that I was a faculty member that should be booted out of the university because I had broken and entered illegally into the Jewish Agency building for this material. So he then asked me if I wanted to answer, and I said, "Well, did they present any evidence for that?" And he said, "No." And then one of them pointed his finger at the president. That wasn't really the thing to do. And he said, "You're obligated to have him answer that question." The president of the university looked at him and said, "No." He said, "I'm obligated to protect my faculty members against such undue charges," and he asked them to leave. Now, I knew right then that I was in the right place to develop my career right there. Mm-hmm. Now, so I'm saying, now that's a good thing. I mean, it doesn't matter whether you think my views are right or my views are wrong. That's not the point, but you get what I'm saying. So I'm saying this long-winded answer is, it's mixed. Listen, it doesn't make me very happy. It doesn't make me very happy when that happens. But of course, if they investigate me a little further, they then have a lot of trouble, because if they find out, I'm a member of a congregation in New York City that's near me. Some of you may not know what this is. One of you, at least you do too, maybe others do. I'm a member of a Lubavitch Hasidic congregation. Mm-hmm. Now, certainly everybody in that congregation doesn't share my point of view, but I can tell you, we meet every Friday night for services. We have about 30 people who come every Friday night. We have a big discussion afterwards. We often discuss Israeli-Palestinian affairs. About 5 of the people are former Israelis who have come to the States. Some of the others are people who have diametrically opposed views to mine. We don't yell at one another. We don't call one another names. We have good, cordial discussions. And I'll say we have disagreements with one another. Well, so that's another way it's sometimes handled. But you know, usually when I'm called all this stuff, some people call me this and say, well, of course, I have to be totally anti-Jewish. Now, I don't like to say I belong to a Lubavitch Hasidic congregation as a defense for my saying that therefore I'm Jewish, but I'm saying it's a little harder to argue that way. So,
I would like to thank you. There's a couple other people that would like to talk with you as well, but I would invite you to do that afterwards if you don't mind. So, thank you so much.
You're welcome.